Welcome to Transcribed, Benchling's podcast where leaders share their personal journeys and hard-won lessons driving scientific progress. Today's guest, Lindsay Edwards, knows what it takes to build AI systems from the ground up. From pioneering the first data science group at GSK to leading AI teams at AstraZeneca, Lindsay is now CTO of Relation Therapeutics, where he's helping redefine the future of data-driven drug discovery.
Thanks for doing this. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. You sound really impressive when someone else kind of does that stuff, but it's not true.
Well, you have a very unique background. I think you are the only person in this room who has produced multiple UK top 10 singles. If anyone has, please.
Anyone?
And now you're the CTO of Relation Therapeutics. Can you just give us the kind of the chapters of your career? And, you know, how did you go from music to drug discovery and machine learning?
Oh, Lord. Not a plan. Mm-hmm. I always wonder when people have this kind of what's your five-year plan thing, because 5 years ago, I had no idea I was going to be where I am now. So, I was a professional musician and a record producer and did a whole bunch of stuff, mainly around producing records for UK radio, so worked with everyone from Sting to Mariah Carey to Whitney Houston, and then my own band, we had a couple of hits in the UK and in Europe, so that was the 90s. And then at some point, it got quiet, which is pretty normal in a music career. I was lucky, I had 10 good years of kind of being working all the time, so that's pretty unusual. But I'd left school at 17, so I was kind of at a loose end.
Okay.
And wasn't really sure what I was going to do. And then there's a much longer version of this. But basically, just discovered that I kind of liked science.
Okay.
Went and did an exercise physiology degree.
So you didn't have a degree, and you did music, and then you went back.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Ended up getting a scholarship at Oxford, and no one was more surprised than me. And just loved it. Loved research. Loved going into the lab. I'm banned from the lab now, but I used to like going into the lab. I've also been like, even as a musician, I used to do a lot of programming. So okay. I've always been kind of...
With electronic music a little bit.
It does. Yeah. And and weirdly enough, there are more parallels than you think. I mean, the thing that I really remember most of all is... like a scientific training, a rigorous scientific training just changed my brain. Mm-hmm. You know, having been a musician for so long and viewing the world through a very particular lens and then learning to view the world through a very different lens, I think it just changed the way my brain was wired, and it took a few years to kind of adjust. And then right from kind of the get-go, I was a career academic from then and never thought about going into industry.
Okay.
So I moved to Australia. I had my own lab in Australia, came back here. I had a lab at King's College London. And we just did stuff like, just kind of me, really. We did biology and we did like computation and we did models of biology. I was always just really excited by the fact that you could... I worked a lot on mitochondrial biology, and you can build these models of mitochondrial biology where the simulations are really good. Hmm. And so you can run experiments on your laptop, and in kind of almost real time, you can knock genes out, you can see how things work, you can change the sorts of function of enzymes, and just do it all sat on your own with a laptop. And I loved that. I loved that whole idea. And so I did that. I got into machine learning. I sort of joke it was weird and not cool to be into machine learning then, and so I would do biology conferences where I would talk about machine learning, and everyone would just
eyes would glaze over.
Yeah. Absolutely. I literally had a slide that had a picture of Santa, and then there's a very famous thing in the UK of these Victorian photographs of fairies at the end of the garden that was like a big. It's a very weird cultural thing. So I had a photograph of them and a photograph of Santa, and I got so peed off that I used to put this thing up at the beginning and go, hands up everyone that thinks that basically what I'm about to say is as credible as these guys. And like half of the people would put their hands up. And then you watched over a kind of 5 year period, it became fewer and fewer people. I would try and get fewer hands going up by the end of the talk than at the beginning.
And is that what led you to industry? Did they?
Yeah, it was a mix of two things. So the first thing was I discovered that raising a young family around London on an academic salary is a fool's errand. So I was going to move back to Australia. I'd been offered a job. We sold our house. And then I got a call from someone at GSK that I just met socially that said, why don't you come work for us? So I did. And then at GSK, at the time, there were no, it was the very beginning of people starting to think about applying machine learning and thinking about data science and kind of part of the drug discovery experiment. And I went to see the head of respiratory, a guy called Dave Allen, and just said, look, if you give me basically a hat, like a title, not literally a hat, but like a, you know, give me a title and 6 months and I'll see what I can do. So I set up the first data science group, I think, sort of certainly in one of the therapy areas at GSK, and kind of built from there. And it was fascinating because, I mean, you must have had this experience, like when you have to build everything from scratch. So we had no data infrastructure, we had IT. So the first thing was kind of, can we unify all of the data across all these different multi-omic studies that we'd been running in things like IPF and asthma and COPD? So one of the first things I built, I mean, I built it, was just like all of those data with a visualization layer over the top. So the scientists could go and type in a gene and see the expression of that gene in all the different patient populations. I mean, really simple.
Yeah.
But it was incredibly useful and got used a lot. So, and it just kind of went from there, really.
Wow. And then what led you to Relation Therapeutics?
So more and more, kind of particularly the last 10 years, it's been increasingly about machine learning and how we can use machine learning to be useful. And I still think we're barely in the foothills in terms of understanding what might be possible. But I'd done, I think, some decent things at GSK. I built things that were useful, which is always a kind of good first pass, and things that have been used. And I built a really good team. And I'd sort of got to the point whereby I knew it was time to move on. I went to AZ, which is a great company. I moved just before COVID. So I sort of, my first few months of working there, I was just sort of sat at home. And it was amazing because my team worked a little bit on the COVID vaccine, which was incredible. And we built some really good stuff. It was a great time to recruit as well. So I built a really good team. But quite quickly, I just got this feeling that I'd moved sideways and it hadn't really scratched the itch.
Mm-hmm. You wanted to build from the ground up.
That, and I think just the sense of the kind of machine learning startup thing, I really wanted to do that. And I'd worked for someone, when I worked for Kim at GSK, Kim Branson, he's very much from that background. So kind of working with Kim had just given me that feeling that it's something that I wanted to do. And then it was just one of those chance things. So Charlie Roberts, who's one of the founders of Relation, he founded a company called Freenome as well, you guys might know. So Charlie and I had met at Neurips, we were talking earlier on about Neurips, by a kind of terrible, you know, those taco vans that pull up outside conferences.
Taco truck, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we met at a taco truck in Long Beach. And he'd started talking to me about Relation. And I think then it was about three people. And I just thought, yeah.
That's it. Not? Yeah. Wow. You've mentioned before that both science and music, you know, require creativity, inspiration, and insight. Can you just elaborate on how that intuition translates into building machine learning systems for drug discovery?
Sure. I mean, can I just, presumably it's a room full of scientists. I'm not wrong, right? It's like, I think that's one of the big misconceptions about science is that it's this kind of dry theoretical thing, but it's incredibly creative. And we have this joke in my house, like when, you know, when you have scientists on TV doing sciencey talk, and I always say to my daughter, like at the scientists, they'll say, oh, we're plugging the, you know, photon collider into that and tell each other exactly what, and it's comical. And yet I think one of the nice things about science is that it is incredibly creative. You have to look at data and think about problems and come up with ideas. And it's just, you know, it's definitely not this dry thing that I think a lot of non-scientists think it is. What was the question about the machine learning?
You answered it. Out of curiosity, like what were you've been in academia, big pharma, startups. Like what's been the most what have been the biggest surprises kind of going from academia to pharma or pharma to startups, both positive and negative?
I think the thing, like, I didn't know I would be a kind of creature of industry. I really didn't. I mean, I'm a musician, right? So, like, I didn't see myself in the cafeteria at GlaxoSmithKline. It just seemed so weird. But I also didn't see myself in the cafeteria at Oxford either, so that was also very weird. I'm definitely a creature of industry more than academia. And I think the reason is that, like, I have a curious nature. Mm-hmm. And I think in academia, it may have changed now, but at the time, what was much more rewarded was like, pick an ion channel and work on that for 30 years, you know? And I'm just not that guy. And you can see people who have great careers doing an ion channel for 30 years, but I'm just too intrigued by shiny things. So my lab did like tissue engineering, and we did machine learning, and we did all sorts of types of computational modeling, and then we did computational modeling of engineered tissue, and it was just like cool, yeah, and fun. But the grant bodies don't have like a way of assessing how cool the stuff you're doing is. And actually, the thing that really did for me is I submitted a grant proposal. I'm just going to sound like a bitter, twisted academic now, but I knew it was good. And it just wasn't getting a fair shake. And it was this kind of combination of engineering, biological systems and modeling them. I think probably now it would land much better. But it just didn't seem to.
Too early.
I think it was too early. It just didn't connect. So when I went to GSK, I think what I really liked, I think two things. First thing is the commitment to being sure of what you're looking at is different because the motivation is different.
Sure, incentive structure is very different.
Yeah, yeah. So in academia, you're just trying to publish. And to be brutally honest, if you get a significant result, you don't want to keep looking until it stops being significant.
Yeah.
Whereas in industry, the kind of, particularly in drug discovery, the final arbiter is a $30 million phase 3 clinical study. So you don't want to be there.
Maybe even more than 30 million.
But yeah, it can be. Depending on the size of the study, it can be a lot more. So you don't want to be at that point finding out that it was just an odd.
So you like the truth-seeking nature.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. And I also like the fact that, I mean, you know, the thing that being able to set up that data science group, there was quite a lot of room to be entrepreneurial inside GSK. And I think there are in these big companies. Mm. If you're willing to kind of go, hey, we're not doing this. Can you give me 6 months to see if I can make it work? Often people will go, yeah, why not?
You've been quite vocal about avoiding the term AI, calling it vague, you know, as vague as saying I'm using engineering for drug discovery. why is this specificity so important?
I think there's two things there. So the first thing is I use it much more now because I think we have technology that is like the term is appropriate for.
Okay. As of this year, yeah.
Well, yeah, as of the last couple of years. And we've got some very nice multi-agent system at Relation that I think is starting to look really, really exciting. So I think that's changed. My main objection to it was the conversation was just like, if you hear someone say we're using AI for drug discovery, I think that's what I was saying, is like, it's as vague as saying I'm using chemistry for drug discovery. Like it lacks any specificity that allows you to have like a mature and interesting conversation about what you're actually doing. And it just leaves it so vague as to be kind of unprosecutable, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whereas what I really want to hear is details. Like, what exactly is the problem we're trying to solve? How are we going to solve it? Crucially, how will we know if it's working? I mean, these things are really hard. Like, we spent a lot of time at Relation trying to figure out how good our models are, whether they're working, how useful are they really? I mean, and it sounds like such a small thing, but it's incredibly difficult because we're trying to model things that are very difficult to test in the lab. It's, you know what I mean? It's not necessarily mm-hmm. straightforward to figure out whether things are working as well as you think they are.
So right now, October 2025, machine learning and drug discovery, like what's real and what's not real?
Structural biology is real.
Okay.
ML for chemistry, a lot of that's real. I think, you know, we've made a big investment into DNA foundation models.
Okay.
That's real. Although there's some nuance there. And actually,
what's the use case there?
So we use it for variant gene mapping.
Okay.
Although I think what we found is it's opening up the problem space a bit more. So what we found is it's probably not, I mean, this you know, when you get these things that actually sound quite obvious, but it, so it's probably not like a one-to-one thing. It's not a variant maps to a gene. It's a variant maps to multiple genes in the locus, and it's context dependent. And so these models allow you to at least try and kind of start to tackle some of that stuff.
What do you feel is overrated right now?
Virtual cells.
Okay. A lot of talk of virtual cells.
Yeah. The phrase I have a reaction to at the moment.
It lacks specificity.
It lacks specificity, but it's also just like madly over kind of promising. So when somebody says virtual cell, when I first said that phrase virtual cell, I imagine a lot of lay people would think a computational model that sort of synthetically captures all of the kind of complexity of a cell. Mm-hmm. We are so far away.
Light years away.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, light years away. So what people actually mean at the moment is predicting gene expression. And that's not a virtual cell. And we're still kind of, that's still a mostly unsolved problem. Actually, very quick, a tiny rant. Like the other problem that happens as well is like, the way that we think about things as machine learning scientists is often really disconnected from the way that biologists need us to think about things.
Okay, so more. That was actually one of the questions I was going to ask you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Shall I just go for it?
Yeah, go for it. What's the mini rant?
Well, so what we tend to do, so I love, as a kind of biologist who's differentiated into a machine learning scientist, like I love the community. I love the fact that everything is open. I love the fact that we are like, I really get annoyed now when I hit a paywall in biology because I'm not used to it. But we have this tradition of like things being treated like competitions, hill climbing in LLMs, for example. So you have a metric, you have a model, you train your model, you try and push your metric up, number goes up and everyone's happy. So you apply that to biology and you get these things where you take like a gene expression data set, lots of perturbations, you split it, you train on some of the data, you replace some of the data, your number goes up and you're really happy as a machine learning scientist, and you go and show your biologist and they're like, yeah, but I've got the numbers. I don't care. Like, I can do that experiment and it's taken you like 3 weeks to create the model. What are you doing? So actually what the biologists want us to do is to predict on cells that the model hasn't seen before. That is much harder because cells, even the same cell in theory, behaves very differently, often for reasons that we don't fully understand. And particularly the more complicated models are very bad out of distribution, AlphaFold included. So like, you've got a model that behaves very well. Formal term is a convex hull, but like, if you imagine your data with a rubber band around it, it functions well within the rubber band because it's got so many parameters. As soon as you go outside, they're terrible. So you've trained a model on this cell, and then Amaya says, can you predict on this other cell? And we're like, no. So there is still this disconnect between the kind of the way that we tend to do things as a machine learning community and what's actually needed from us.
How do you bridge that? Like, even at your own company, how do you get the machine learning scientists and biologists to be talking enough to, you know, make sure that this problem doesn't happen?
Yeah, so I wish I had a really good answer to that question. I think I know some of the things. I think as a community, we've tried things that seem intuitively reasonable that haven't worked. So I would say, funny enough, I had this conversation yesterday at a thing with a friend of mine, Steve Crossan, who used to be at DeepMind, where he, I don't think the answer is to teach biologists how to code. I'm not sure the answer is necessarily to teach machine learning folk about biology, because I think what tends to happen is they just don't learn things that are useful. Whereas if you get people to coexist around a problem and you've got smart autodidacts, they'll tend to learn the stuff that they need to learn as they go. So I think the best recipe is really to like form interdisciplinary groups of people, give them a fairly clearly defined objective, and just give them the time and space to go and figure out how to do it rather than being too prescriptive. But again, that can be challenging if you're trying to build a company as well. And
sure.
it's like kind of surfing that.
And I imagine you've got to have some kind of centralized capabilities in your machine learning teams and your biology teams and so forth. So you can't just sort of organize around a single program, right?
Yeah. Yes. And you have to be you sort of have to be shipping simultaneously. So yeah. There is that kind of, but I think that's the same for all of us.
One thing you've said before is like, one can train models that score quite well on traditional ML metrics while not solving anything of real impact. I think that's your rant.
Nothing is not consistent, Sanjay.
How do you How do you think about the gap between having very powerful AI models that are kind of off the shelf and taking them and making them useful for scientific work?
So I think that kind of breaks into two classes of models. So you've got foundation models. And I mean, like, the promise of foundation models is real and it's not new. I think we have to be realistic about some of the history here. So if you look at kind of when vision models first broke through in 2014.
AlexNet.
Yeah. We were talking then about kind of using those general representations and fine tuning them. But it was quite a few years. I think contrastive loss was the first thing that allowed you to train a kind of more multi-purpose embedding that could then be useful for other things. Until then, supervised learning still beat all kind of all comers. I think we're still there. So in our hands, whenever we train these DNA foundation models, the ones that are trained on a supervised task outperform things like the nucleotide transformer or Evo. And again, it's just about like finding the right pretext task to do that. But in theory, you could have a good general purpose DNA foundation model that you can fine tune into stuff. You could have a good general purpose cell model in theory, but we have to figure out. So again, I'm not sure of the audience, so forgive me. Do we have any like hardcore machine learning people, or am I losing the room? Who knows what a pretext task is? Amazing, okay, cool. So when you wanna train a model, so you've got these two types of models. You can train them doing a supervised thing. So you have some data that's labeled and you train on the label, or you have it on an unsupervised task where you don't have labels. So large language models are trained on an unsupervised task where they train like what you mask a word and you predict the next word. We call that a pretext task. So in DNA modeling, you could do the same pretext task. You could say, here's a stretch of DNA. I'm gonna blank out a couple of letters and I want you to replace the letters for me. Makes perfect sense. There's a couple of models that have been trained that way. You could do it on gene expression data. You could say, I'm going to hide some of the gene expression data. I want you to predict. So the advantage of that stuff is you don't need labels. You don't need humans going through trying to identify cell types and stuff. But the downside is the pretext task has to be good enough for the model to learn something useful. And in language, it clearly is. Like, if you mask out words and it has to predict the next word, it needs to learn a lot about language and a lot about the world in order to complete that task. When you do it with DNA, I think it learns a lot about codons and some other conserved sequences. Beyond that, how is it going to know what is a regulatory element if it's not seen some other stuff? So that's for me is like the gap at the moment. There's a lot of research to be done in figuring out, like, is there a pretext task? Are they just going to have to stay supervised? Are there better supervision tasks that you can train on?
So speaking of data, you've talked about biology's data bottleneck before. Yep. That our measurements are messy, inconsistent, hard for machines to learn from. You've actually said that biologists need to be more like physicists. What does that mean? And what does that mean? And what needs to kind of change in biology to solve the data bottleneck?
So what I meant was, we've been measuring things in arbitrary units. I'm a biologist as well at heart.
Yeah. So you can say that, right?
Okay, yeah, yeah. Away with it. We've basically been measuring things in arbitrary units for the whole of our discipline. Like, because measuring things in absolute units is really hard. So, you know, if we're doing gene expression, generally what we do is we look at the expression of a gene compared to some control that we've randomized in an experiment to make sure that all of the kind of batch effects have been marginalized out. I mean, even when we go to the doctor, quite often they will take some measurement that isn't necessarily consistent and it's compared with some internal control or within some normal range. So we have this culture of like, the numbers don't necessarily mean anything in isolation. They only mean something when you compare it alongside something else, which has been absolutely fine for the entire history of biology. But it's a death knell when you're trying to train models on it, because very often the effects that we're interested in are confounded with the batches that we normally get rid of by doing like clever randomization on plates and stuff. And so the models just learn things like batch effects. And I think one of the things that you learn quite early on in your kind of machine learning career is the models will learn what suits them generally, sure, not what suits you. And it's very easy to convince yourself that the models have learned something that you wanted them to learn. More often than not, they will have learned the easiest way of doing the thing that you've asked them to do.
And physics has this solved?
Well, they're more used to measuring things in absolute values, I think. And AlphaFold is a really, really good example where you've got two sets of measurements where they are naturally aggregatable across labs, across time and across space.
Very objective, yeah.
So if you measure sequence, like if you do it here or you do it in Kendall Square,
it's going to be the same.
Approximately the same. Mm-hmm. Or at least like the biases are it might be things like odd substitutions, mm-hmm. but they're not going to throw the whole system off. And then structure is, the measurements of structure aren't great, but they're in angstrom distances. So again, if you take all of those structures and all of those sequences across all the different labs, you can combine all of that data and train models on it. Gene expression is a really good example of sets of data where that's just not true. Mm. And the challenge would be having laboratory systems where you can measure something so consistently that you have an reproducible absolute value. And I don't know, I mean, I have no idea what that is, whether it's like literal transcripts per cell or transcripts per microliter or something that's so reproducible that you measure it in a cell here and you measure it in the same system somewhere else. And then
sure, shared vocabulary across all scientists.
Yeah.
At Benchling, we think a lot about data standardization and infrastructure. From your perspective, being at the cutting edge of machine learning, what's the most critical infrastructure problem that's holding back progress?
In compute or in the on the lab side?
Either. Just at the forefront of machine learning. Yeah.
I don't, like, it's weird because there doesn't feel like there's a technological bottleneck in machine learning right now. The compute is like just vast what's available. I mean, I kind of think it's too much.
Hmm. Like there's not enough constraints?
Yeah. It's like, you'll have had this same experience. Kind of, I realize now a few years into relation, and I'm not saying this for us, but you watch other companies and they have these huge raises and you think, oh, that's lucky them. They've raised $500 million. But then somehow they just kind of lose their way. It's like they've got too much money, yes. And you can lose focus in those settings. And I think it's happened a bit with machine learning. So you've got tens of thousands of GPUs being stood up by amazing companies like CoreWeave and Nebius. We just published a paper, at Neurips where we've got a really, really good DNA foundation model, 19 million parameters, so tiny by today's standard, yeah. Topping the charts on performance. And just because we're tokenizing slightly differently, and it's kind of, if you've got 10,000 GPUs to throw at stuff, you kind of don't have to have the discipline that you need if you've got, do you see what I mean? Like a yeah. smaller number. But actually, you're just not making use of the compute that's available to you. You just kind of, I've got it, so I'm going to throw it at my problem.
Sure. Having a lot of constraints forces creativity.
It does.
And focus.
I mean, DeepSeek is a really good example.
Yeah, that's the one I was thinking of when you were saying that. You've emphasized that lab in the loop isn't just about sort of getting data to feed models, but about models driving the experiments. Can you give us a concrete example of how a model prediction has changed what you've done in the lab?
I mean, in terms of the way that we've had to validate the DNA foundation model, again, it's been really difficult to do well. And actually, again, this is one of those things where there is a natural tension at the heart of it, which is either like really fascinating or an incredible, like a really tough challenge, both things at the same time. So, for example, in drug discovery, you're trying to generate data with systems that gives you some notion of whether something is going to be effective in a patient. But the sort of the further back down the line you get, you've got more tractable systems that are less predictive of what happens. So you might have a system that's like an immortalized cell line.
Sure.
It's not really going to be massively predictive of what happens in a patient. And now you've got computational models. So you can train your computational models on your cellular data. Now you've got another system that predicts something.
Sure, you've just added a layer of abstraction.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But you can validate it. You can validate it because the system that's tractable, so this is like scenario one, or like with the DNA foundation models, what we're trying to do is predict like phenotypic effects in humans. So we look at GWAS and we try and fine-tune the models to see whether like variants in genes are predictive. How do you test whether that's right or not? You can't go and do, you can't, yeah. So we've tried a bunch of different things. I mean, one of the things we do, which I'm really proud of, is we pick the hard task rather than the one that's likely to succeed. Exactly for the reason that we said before, because if we're wrong,
we need to know now. Yeah,
yeah, let's find out now.
Yeah.
So what we did in the end, and I think we're going to publish this hopefully reasonably soon, was with this DNA foundation model, we picked these situations where you've got a variant, you've got a bunch of genes. The nearest gene, which is the one that all the other kind of heuristics tend to go for, is one that everyone goes, oh, yes, that's the bone biology, because we work in bone. That's the bone biology one. And the model is picking one over here. We're like, okay, so in this case, the model is disagreeing, confidently disagreeing with everyone else. Let's test that. So you knock out the one that's the nearest gene that everyone thinks it is. You knock out the one that Rosalind predicts. And what was interesting is Rosalind was right more often.
That's the name of the foundation model.
Rosalind is, okay. Not just some random person. And but the other really neat thing was sometimes both of them
are wrong.
You know, yeah, both of them are wrong, and sometimes both of them are right. Hmm. And that's that whole thing about kind of it isn't like one variant to one gene. It's much subtler, and you know, it's biology.
Speaking of bones, so big focus for Relation is osteoporosis.
Yep.
Currently, you collect bone waste.
Yes.
And you are the only lab that can do single cell on bone data, which is then used to train models. Can you talk to us about why patient-derived data is so much more valuable than working with just the cell lines or animal models in this case?
Well, exactly that, because the final arbiter of whether these things are going to work or not is when you give them to a patient. So the more information you can get about the patient population. I mean, I guess the other thing I would say is, like, it's easy to forget. We tend to sort of start with diseases and go, well, osteoporosis, for example. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, a guy called Hugh Montgomery, used to say that these diseases were dreamt up by Victorian gentlemen in top hats, which is true. So you take something like asthma, you take something like osteoporosis, they're defined by their kind of grossest clinical manifestation.
Sure.
So a broken leg or wheezing. But actually, we now know that a lot of these diseases are kind of multiple different molecular mechanisms
Sure.
that just converge on the same thing. So the real place to start is the patients and to look to see kind of what biological kind of structure there is in those.
How does one collect bone waste?
You just, well, so there's a lot of bone waste from things like hip and knee replacements.
Okay.
So particularly hip, the most common fracture in older people is you've got literally like a ball and a socket, mm-hmm. and they fracture across the femoral neck here, and I think they just like take that bit out, replace it, and it just goes in the bin. Hmm. So we have it instead. Wow. Obviously, we can send them first.
Yeah. But
then Rosalind round. Yeah.
One thing you've said that I thought was interesting is you said companies should not sink resources into curating old data, but instead have kind of uniform policies so every single piece of data acquired from now on will be machine learning ready. Like, what does that mean in practice?
I'm getting quite anxious of all the things that I've said.
we do our research.
I know, it's horrifying. So that was, I think that was more of a comment on my own mistakes and a comment on, I think, the ongoing policies of a number of large companies. So I don't know where I said that, but I stand by it. So I think the temptation, remember I said like my first data science job at GSK, we got all the data in.
Yeah, and you built the visualization. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that did work. But there's a temptation to look at your kind of data estate if you're a massive company and go, we've got all this data, it must be worth something. Mm. And then you spend $1 million or $2 million bringing in consultants who will pull all this stuff together and do some kind of freaky normalization. So it like to get rid of all those batch effects we were talking about. And then to find that kind of it's not really useful. And there's a bunch of different reasons why it's not useful. I think the most common one is with biology particularly, there's so many things that we don't see and don't measure. Mm. And until you know to measure it, you're not just going to measure it by accident. So it's just like a bunch of measurements that are probably unrelated in any interesting way to the thing that you're. So there's that. And I guess for me, it was another one of those moments where I thought, like, if I ever do this again, and unlikely because I'm having a great time at Relation, but I think what I would advocate for is to say, just forget about it all. Like, yes, we've got a lot of data sat in S3 buckets all over the place, but rather than spending $2 million trying to figure out how we're going to drag marginal value out of it, let's just spend that money making sure that every single clinical study we run from now on, we run SomaLogic or something, so just something really consistent, and we have really consistent protocols. And within 3 years, you'd have an industry-defining data set. And actually, I think recursion really showed how quickly you could go from a standing start to an industry-defining data set. And they started releasing it into the public domain. And it was like, yeah, let's do that.
How do you see ML changing over the next few years in terms of, like, it's a very exciting time in AI and machine learning. Like, how do you see how we understand and treat disease evolving over the next, say, two, three years?
I think now more than ever, it's a really, really kind of, I'm always more or less excited about it because I've always kind of loved machine learning as a field. But I think we are genuinely at a point where things will start to have a real impact, which seems like an odd thing to say because people have been talking about it having an impact for years. Mm-hmm. But the truth is it hasn't, really. And there's been, yeah, that gap, we were talking about it before, the gap between having a model that kind of works, quotes unquotes, to something that's useful is actually far bigger than people realize. Like you get these, you've got a model that does something interesting,
yeah,
academically interesting, yeah, have to make it useful. But I think there is a lot of promise. I think the DNA foundation models look good. A lot of the kind of protein folding stuff's obviously starting to take off. Antibody design, mm-hmm, looking really, really interesting now. Chemical design, ISO, look really, really exciting. I think the cell models will. Like, I think we're getting to a point whereby, the opportunity is there. The big gap, I think, for the cell models is the data still. So kind of there's a lot of observational expression data out there. But if you want to understand a system as complicated as a cell, you need to poke it a lot.
Yeah. What has to happen for you to say, hey, the machine learning drug discovery has made an impact?
I mean, we need to see drugs that wouldn't exist otherwise. But, you know, that's the hard test.
Yeah.
So
approved medicines. Yeah.
Yeah. That wouldn't exist without it. I don't think we've seen that yet. Like we've had an effect around the edges and we can speed things up.
Yeah.
And that's all good.
It takes a long time to make a medicine.
It does take a long time to make a medicine.
Yeah.
So there is that kind of natural lag as well. It'll come. It will come, but it's going to take a while. I think what would be really helpful is to just kind of lower the temperature of the conversation a little bit. And, you know, referring back to the point at the beginning, it's going to get into the nitty gritty of exactly what are we doing? How is it going to help? How will we know if it's worked? I mean, there are a lot of really, really excited, smart people in the machine learning community that really, really want to get their kind of teeth into meaty problems. And we struggle to give them those problems at the moment. And again, that's one of those things where once you get that, if you get a really, like, again, AlphaFold's a really good example. The fact that CASP existed made that whole thing possible. And the more we have these kind of foundational biology challenges with a really, really good data set that's just the right level of hard, then I think we can see more of that progression. I think the one other thing as well, this came up yesterday too, is drug discovery isn't the only reason to do biological, mm-hmm, like machine learning. There's tons and tons of interesting stuff that might not at the face of it look like it's going to be transformed. It's just a really important problem that needs solving. And then the drug discovery stuff happens as a side effect.
What do you think of? What are you thinking of when?
DNA foundation models is a good one, but again, finding the right
still in the life sciences though. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. But even within biology, I mean, with the virtual cell stuff, I think in the synthetic biology community where you're trying to like build simple biological systems from the ground up, it's not got an immediate application. And things like yeast, you know, I mean, they are simpler than human cells, but we have a reasonably good understanding of the gene regulatory network. You can get libraries of yeast where literally you've got like clonal yeast lines with each of the single genes.
Yep.
You can cross them so you can get double knockouts and stuff. So there's a lot of tools from the systems biology community that are really useful. And I think solving something simpler would be good.
Sure, a rising tide will lift all boats.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Maybe to close, like for the, you know, you've got the next generation of scientists in this room, many just entering the field. Like, what's your advice for working at the frontier of machine learning and biology for them?
Just be excited. Do stuff that you love. I just, I've been very blessed to have had two careers where I've been excited going to work. And it's really kind of simple advice, but I think it's fundamental. I couldn't have survived doing things that fundamentally didn't make me happy. And I think there's also a difference between like the lofty aspirations of I'm going to work today to cure cancer or whatever, which is great. I mean, it's good. And we have a very strong culture at Relation of the fact that we are trying to get medicines to patients as quickly as possible. But you have to love it too, you know. And we're blessed being at a kind of time when there's some really interesting problems with some really kind of fascinating technology available and this huge white space that you can then go in and occupy and try stuff out.
Best time ever to be a scientist.
It's got to be up there.
Maybe final question then. What about the scientists who want to become musicians? Any advice?
I'm learning to play chess at the moment,
yeah.
And I'm bad. And you learn pretty quickly that if you didn't start playing chess when you were four, your opportunities to be good at chess are extremely limited. And the only analogy I've got is like, I started playing piano when I was four. So I can just play piano. It drives my daughter insane. Like I can sit down and just play and she just makes her angry. And it's just the same when there's like chess players and they just seem to have this natural ability. So if you're planning now to be a professional musician, you might have left it too late. If you're going to do it just for fun, I would say have a blast. Just do it for that reason. Don't think that you're going to become a pro.
Lindsay, thank you so much. This was fabulous.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.